Yeah, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk at this wonderful place. So actually, this is my first time visiting PI, and so far, I've really enjoyed my discussions. So today, I will be telling you about a few things which are which can be found in these papers. And these were mostly in collaboration with my advisor, Shinsei Ryu, and a former postdoc of our group, Ken Shiozaki. So here's the outline. It looks probably a little bit ambitious, and I know that you guys had a busy day so far. Probably you went to a lot of talks. So I try to make it fun as much as I can. I don't know how really, but let's see. Okay, so I start with a brief introduction to topological phases of fermions. And then, so the main part of my talk will be about many-body topological invariants of topological superconductors. And so this is very general, and we try to study it for different symmetry classes of fermions. But in this talk, I will focus on a specific case, which is just 1D. Systems. And so turns out there is a relation between many-body topological invariants of topological superconductors in the presence of time reversal symmetry and some operation which is well known in the context of quantum information theory, which is called partial transpose. So this topological invariant gives a natural definition for partial transpose of fermions. So then one can use just the partial transpose itself to study quantum information theory where the building blocks are fermions as opposed to qubits. And also, so in that context, I will discuss a little bit entanglement negativity. And then, if time permits, I will tell you another application, which is in the context of StatMech, where one can study the effect of finite temperature or like the effect of thermal fluctuations on quantum systems. Okay, so I'll be brief here. So as you know, conventionally, phases of matter are thought to be fully characterized by broken symmetries, and local order parameters such as density in this case or magnetization in that case can be used to distinguish one phase from another. But turns out this story is rather incomplete, and topological phases of matter are big exceptions to this. So here I'm just showing some experimental systems which show which exhibit topological phases of matter. So the thing is, these phases appear in the electronic structure, such as in topological insulators in these two cases, or topological superconductors. They locally look featureless because they are insulators or superconductors, but then on their boundaries they have these exotic boundary modes. Like, for example, here in the case of topological superconductors, there are this propagating edge modes. In the case of three-dimensional topological insulators, there are Dirac-like surface states. And in the case of topological superconductors, there are Majorana zero modes, which were found to have many applications in different areas, including quantum information theory. So, I'm going to focus on topological superconductors and particularly one-dimensional case, but the idea is rather general. So I'm looking for a sort of an order parameter which is necessarily has to be non-local, because as I mentioned, locally you cannot really distinguish topological phases from trivial phases. And then the requirement is that it works for many-body systems. Okay, so I don't require any single particle description. And then it's an order parameter in the sense that you gain information by studying the bulk. Okay, and one can think of this many-body topological invariant as just a machinery where the input is a ground state or a state wave function, and you do some computation, you compute some expectation value. So then what I mean here by non-local is the support of this operator is large enough compared to the bulk correlation length, and the output is some quantized number, which we can relate it to many-body topological invariant. So let me be a little bit more concrete and give you an example. So I will focus on 1D and a prototype of topological phases in 1D for fermions, of course, is P-wave superconductivity. The lattice realization of that is just take complex fermions with Hopping term and a pairing potential. And then you add a chemical potential. So as a function of chemical potential, you may get a trivial phase and a topological phase. And they are separated by a topological phase transition. So let me be more specific here. So if you take a piece of one-dimensional topological superconductor, the topological phase is different from the trivial phase if you just look at the spectrum, the energy spectrum. You see that in the trivial phase, so the spectrum, first of all, has this particle hole symmetry, which is a feature of the superconductivity. So these are this Bogoliubov-Dijon eigenvalues. And in the case of topological superconductor, you get this twofold degenerate zero modes. And they are actually these states at the boundary. So then topological superconductor is different from trivial superconductor for having these zero modes.
So there is no condition on D divided by delta for this classification?
So I assume that T is equal to delta right now for this model.
Okay.
And then there are two phases. So they are all, so in 2D, they are known as weak pairing and strong pairing, where the chemical potential lies out of the band structure or not, yeah. So more generally, the Kitaev model can be thought of as a canonical example of a class BD1. It's just a topological superconductors in the presence of time reversal symmetry. And time reversal symmetry in this case is simply complex conjugation, and T squared is equal to 1. The non-interacting classification is integer, and that is associated with just number of zeros. So there are multiple ways to understand this. One way is just by studying the boundary states and the so-called gapability criterion. So for example, if you consider two topological superconductors next to each other, the question is whether you can write a term which couples these two and removes the degeneracy from the zero energy. And so in the case of when you impose time reversal symmetry, then that means any term that couples these two necessarily break time reversal, so they are protected. That's where this topological protection or symmetry protection comes in here in this example. So more generally, one can define topological invariant in this case is a winding number that you can define in Brillouin zone. So you have a band and you can look at the evolution of some Berry phase that gives you a winding number. That's also another way of characterizing a topological superconductor. So in the trivial case, there is no winding number, but if you have a topological superconductor, you get some integer. Okay, that's also where this integer classification emerges in this case, yes.
So for the model in question, what are the boundary conditions? Do you have open boundary conditions or?
Oh, for winding number?
No. For the previous model that you introduced, the Kitaev chain.
Oh, this is just, yeah, so these are all open boundary conditions.
Okay.
So it's just an open chain. Yeah. But so we want to just study actually the bulk. And right now, for example, the first criterion that I showed, it was by studying the edge. Right, so this is like a representative of a general approach. Okay, so it can be applied to other topological phases. And this method is a representative of the second approach, which is to study the bulk where you impose a periodic or antiperiodic, where you put the system on a closed manifold.
So I'm confused about it because my understanding of topological order is that if you have a system and just change the topology, there are going to be features that will depend on this. So for instance, the degeneracy of the ground state.
Oh, okay. So I should have clarified that at the beginning. So first of all, right now I'm in 1D. So there's no topological order in 1D. So there's no topological degeneracy on a closed manifold. And also, if you want to consider a generic case here, I'm talking about this SPT, symmetry protected topological phase. Without imposing symmetry, it's a trivial theory. There is no ground state degeneracy. It's just you can adiabatically connect this to a trivial phase, a product state, by a set of local unitaries. But those unitaries break the symmetry, yeah, if you impose the symmetry, yeah. That's why it is not adiabatically connected to a trivial phase. So there is also another approach where one can study just the structure of the space of the block Hamiltonians. And so here I'm just showing you this celebrated periodic table of non-interacting fermions. So different; these are just the symbols for different symmetry classes, and these are the non-interacting classifications. But the story gets more interesting when you consider interactions. So for example, if you take this approach, this was originally done by Fitkowski and Kitaev. And if you ask, what if you add a quartic term or arbitrary number of fermion interactions, then would you get, again, the integer classification or something different? And turns out the integer classification is reduced to Z8 from Z. That means if you take 8 copies of the topological superconductors, effectively you can adiabatically connect it to a trivial phase. Okay, so since we are interested in finding a many-body topological invariant, it has to capture this effect, the Z8 classification. Even if you you construct your many-body state as a in terms of the non-interacting wave functions, okay? Because the input is just a many-body state. So even if you construct a many-body state out of non-interacting orbitals, you still get the Z8 classification because it's a many-body formalism. So let me recap a little bit. So we're going to use some basic ideas from perhaps the oldest example of topological invariant, what is known as TKNN invariant. TKNN invariant is a topological invariant for insulators in two spatial dimensions. And so this is, the single particle picture. So you start with going to momentum space, reciprocal lattice space, and this shows a Brillouin zone. And note that in this case, so this is a square lattice, so this edge is identified with this edge, because they are separated by a reciprocal lattice vector, same for these two edges, and effectively you get a torus. And you can look at the Berry phases as you go around this torus. So as you move around here, you get here, so meaning that here you're you're going around the cycle of a torus. You can accumulate a Berry phase in the non-trivial case, whereas in the trivial phase, it's a zero. And long story short, you can define some topological invariant, so-called Chern number, which is the integral of Berry curvature over the Brillouin zone. And this is related to Hall conductance. Although this is a theoretical calculations in terms of this Berry connections, but it's a nice property that in this case, topological invariant appears as a physical response. So the The non-interacting picture can be generalized to a many-body picture. And the idea is that instead of now looking at the berry phases within the brilliant zone, now we twist the boundary condition. So this is now twisting the many-body wave function. And by that, I mean take the wave function on a torus. So this is a closed manifold. This is real space, x and y. And as a particle moves and goes across this boundary, it ends up on the other boundary, and it picks up a U1 phase. Okay, you can solve the Hamiltonian by imposing that boundary condition. That gives you a set of many-body states. And because these two boundary these are U1 phases, so they are defined modulo 2 pi. Effectively, you get a family of many-body wave functions over this torus, of the boundary condition, twisted boundary condition, this picture. And very similar, so this is, now this should remind you the non-interacting Brillouin zone, right? It's kind of a many-body generalization of this. And one can do something very similar. You can define a berry connection and a berry curvature, and eventually define a many-body chair number. So in this case, because the classification of interacting and non-interacting fermions is not different, so you get, again, an integer classification. But the important message that I would like to convey here is seems like topological phases responds to twisting boundary conditions. So this is an important point. So we're going to use this in the case of topological superconductors. So we don't have a U1 phase, yes?
So I wanted to ask you, this many-body chair number,
yes.
You have a definition.
Yes.
You apply the definition to a system that accepts a single particle
yes.
description.
Yes.
You get back
to the
beautiful.
Yes. So
you
can do the calculation rather explicitly. So the question is, if we plug in the single particle orbitals here, like if we rewrite this in terms of Slater determinants, then this expression becomes the same as this. Yeah. And so if you impose, so this expression actually is rather more general, so it doesn't assume any translational symmetry in real space. And if you assume translational symmetry, you can show that this is uniform. So every point would be the same as the full berry curvature. So berry curvature at every point here in this picture is the same as the total chair number in the previous picture, if you impose translation symmetry and you write the Slater determinant in terms of plane waves.
So yeah. this is for non-interacting system.
Yes, no, the question was that if you use the many-body framework to apply to non-interacting fermions, would you recover this picture?
So what about?
And then the answer is yes.
What about interacting system?
Yes.
Will it apply?
Yes, yes. This is fully interacting picture. Yes.
Okay. So you basically pick up one coordinate and do it.
Yes. Yes. So you have these two boundary conditions, and these are defined for a many-body state. There is no assumption about whether there is interaction or not. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, this example was just a motivation, and the take-home message here is that perhaps if we try twisting the boundary conditions, then we should be able to distinguish topological phases from trivial phases. So we're going to experiment this idea, but there are two different parts. So first of all, we're going to try it on partition functions. So we are working in 1D. So if you want to really take something 2D, so there would be a partition function. You will see, actually, it's not just that, but there is the imaginary time path integral that we are going to use. And we're going to twist the boundary conditions of the path integral there by the symmetry that we have, which is time reversal and fermion parity. And then the next goal would be to, so now if we show that, when we show that partition function works, next question is, can we write a canonical formalism for that partition function? Can we write this in terms of some ground state expectation value, so that we can, because we are condensed matter physicists, so we are interested in wave functions. So we are given a wave function. We want to determine whether that wave function represents a topological phase or not. So this is then more relevant. And what I call topological invariant is just a canonical formalism in terms of the ground state wave function, not partition function. Okay, so the important observation that we're going to use is a partition function of a gapped quantum system generally can be dependent on if there is some on-site symmetry, and then you can gauge it. It depends on that, depends on the manifold itself, and then depends on the boundary conditions on the cycles of that manifold. So this is called spin structures, if you know. So for topological phases, if you choose proper background and spin structures, then in general, there will be some complex phase. And that's actually what we're going to use. If we choose the some appropriate manifold, then we'll see that there will be a complex phase, and this complex phase can be served as a topological invariant. So in a trivial phase, it's always a real number, whereas in a topological phase, there will be a phase, complex phase. Okay, so now let's go back to our example. So we were considering a time reversal symmetric superconductor. So the symmetries available in this system certainly is not a U1 particle number conservation. So we have only we are dealing with a superconductor, we have only the fermion parity symmetry, and then we impose time reversal symmetry. So now let's go ahead and twist the boundary conditions of the space-time path integral. So originally, so this is the imaginary time axis, this is the spatial direction, and the path integral is a partition, the partition function is a path integral on a torus. So we identify this edge with that edge, these are the spatial boundary conditions, and then we identify this edge with the other edge. This is the temporal boundary conditions. And if you want to twist these two boundary conditions by the fermion parity symmetry, it means simply we twist the boundary condition from periodic to antiperiodic here or there. Okay, we don't change the topology of the space-time manifold. So that's all we have available for this symmetry. But now, if we twist by time reversal, so what I mean by that is if you start here at tau equals tau zero, and move across the boundary, you end up here at tau equals minus tau. So as you move across the boundary, you change the orientation. And this is a hallmark of twisting by orientation reversing symmetries, and it was known and used earlier in our group in a different context. But right now what I'm saying is if you twist the spatial boundary condition, by time reversal, it's a torus, but now we change the orientation. It is simply a Klein bottle. So that's what we're going to use. So perhaps topological superconductors respond to Klein bottle if we compute the partition function. And it can be actually more, you can just consider all possible cases. So here I just showed the torus, and then there are four boundary conditions, right? Periodic and antiperiodic in this direction, periodic and antiperiodic in that direction. So for Klein bottle, you can do both. So we already twist this this boundary by time reversal, but also we can twist by fermion parity. We can go even further if we assume some rotation symmetry, then we can also do this twisting by time reversal in this direction too. Okay, so here, effectively, we get a real projective plane. Okay, now let's look at the result here. I'm showing you the partition functions on different manifolds. So on a torus, There is actually only one place where we see a difference between topological superconductors and trivial superconductors, and it's when you impose both periodic boundary conditions along the space and time directions. And what it gives is, for a single copy of the Majorana chain, in the topological phase, it gives you minus one, but in the trivial phase, it gives you one. So at most, it distinguishes one single copy from a trivial phase. So it gives you a Z2 classification. And clearly, this is not a complete classification. So for example, if you take the two copies of the topological superconductors, it gives you no phase. That means, I mean, from perspective of this, it can only distinguish odd number of chains. Okay. Yes.
At the beginning, you defined this topological property by looking at the many-body ground state wave function.
Yes.
Then you defined partition function, which in some sense explores all states. So what is
right.
necessary to?
Okay, so actually that's a very good question. So here, what I'm saying is the zero temperature partition function. Effectively, I'm taking the temporal
direction.
Yes, to be infinite, yeah.
It's a formal tool.
Yeah.
You're taking zero temperature.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so this is actually an interesting question because one can think of finite temperature like SPT phases at finite temperature states using this framework. I'm not gonna discuss it here. Maybe if you're interested, we can talk about it later. But yeah, there are some applications to study finite temperature states of topological phases using this framework. So then if we go ahead and compute the partition function on Klein-Bottel, again, there is a cycle on Klein-Bottel. We need to impose periodic boundary condition there, and then we get fourth root of unity. Okay, that means if you have a single so these are all the results for the single Majorana chain. If you have now four copies of the topological superconductor, again, you get nothing but the trivial phase. So then Klein-Bottel at most can distinguish multiples of four. So it gives you a Z4 classification. And then one can do a similar thing for RP2, and then it is, one can observe that we get Z8 classification. So for a single copy, for the single topological superconductor, it gives the 8th root of unity. Then RP2 can distinguish all these possible states. So there is there's more to that. So I will get to some details and some mathematics significance of this later. But for now, let's focus on whether we can write these in a canonical formalism. So let's first take the first manifold. So in the case of torus, it's actually very simple. You can change the temporal boundary condition by inserting a fermion parity operator. So any continuous, any on-site symmetry actually can be twisted using this method. So that's been known. You don't change the manifold, the manifold itself, what you just change the boundary condition along the time direction. But now the question is, now that we observe that partition functions really give you some non-trivial information and can distinguish different phases, can we write an expression in terms of ground state wave functions or not? So the guiding principle that we're going to use is some basics from topology. So there is this object called crosscap, and it's being used in high energy, also in context of topological phases. So it's simply when you cut out a disk out of a manifold, and then you identify the points using some antipodal map. It's just identifying opposite points. Okay, this gives you a crosscap. And one can show that Klein-Bottel is the same as creating or putting two crosscaps on a sphere. Okay, so then the object that is useful for us would be this crosscap. Can we create these crosscaps in the operator formalism? So in case of RP2 is the same as a sphere with one crosscap. So now let me show you how to simulate crosscap in canonical formalism in terms of a ground state wave function. So what we want to do is the following. So we have this space-time, right? We make a cut this way along the vertical direction, but it's a partial cut. You see, I'm not going from like the beginning of time to the end of the time. I mean, these are identified, but I'm just saying making a partial cut. And then we make this identification. This effectively gives me a crosscap. And one can do calculations to see that this works at the level of partition function. But now the next question is whether can we implement this in the ground state wave function. And here I'm going to show you how to implement it using matrix product states. But I'm using matrix product state here just as a way of representation. So it's not essential to implement this method in matrix product state. In other words, it can be applied to states where you don't have the MPS representation. Okay, as you probably know very well, matrix product state is a representation of the wave function, and we have these matrices. These show some degrees of freedom about spatial correlations, auxiliary bonds, and these are the physical bonds. And physical bonds count the configurations of the physical degrees of freedom. And one can also apply this not just for the spin chains, all other sorts of things, including fermions and chiral phases. Okay, now let's try to see what we can do here. So the closest thing we can start with is just a density matrix. Okay, this is the density matrix in this MPS representation. And you see I have these physical bonds which are not connected. So these represent my degrees of freedom. And the simplest thing we can first try is just apply time reversal operator. So if you apply time reversal operator to part of the system, to this density matrix, what we get is effectively a transposition operator, because density matrix is a Hermitian operator, right? So then it becomes transpose. And then this unitary part is just a unitary part of the time reversal. I just put it to make it a generic case. And since we want to create a partial time reversal, and probably partial complex conjugation is not trivial to implement, but since now we relate the complex conjugation to transposition, then we can define partial transpose, okay? And by that I mean take the density matrix and apply the transposition only to part of your system. So now I'm dividing the, so here I have the I1 and I2, these are just some spatial regions of the density matrix, and I apply the transpose only to part of the system. And in the context of fermions, actually this partial, before I get to the fermions, let me remind you what partial transpose is in operator formalism. So remember that full transpose is just when you exchange the ket with bra, right? All the indices from here go there. Then partial transpose is defined by exchanging only the indices from part of the global system. So if I have like two sets of local orthonormal states, now I'm exchanging only the first part, which corresponds to subsystem one. So this is a nice operation if these states are bosonic states or the statistics are trivial. But in case of fermions, it's not really a trivial task that you move things around. Like for example, this guy collides with that guy as you move them around, right? So they may have both odd fermion parity, then they may pick up a minus sign as you exchange them. So then that needs to be done carefully. And so if you start from the space-time path integral, one can see that, for example, in the Fock space basis, as you do the partial transpose, there will be a phase factor, which accounts for the difference between the fermion parities of these states. So this phase only depends on the fermion parity of these states of the subsystem. That's something that has to be done correctly. So now let me show you the topological invariant. So the topological invariant can be written as rho partial transpose. And so these unitaries, remember, is just the unitary part of the time reversal operator. And it looks something like this. So rho times rho partial transpose, and you just do the usual identification, the upper rho with the lower rho, and then the lower rho with the upper rho. And yeah, if you look at this picture for a long time and then do some diffeomorphism, if you just move things smoothly around, you should be able to. So you should be able to see that this picture represents or topologically equivalent to RP2. So here I'm just showing you a cartoon picture of that. So these are the two density matrices, and these two show the two intervals here and there. And effectively, this object of partial transpose of two adjacent intervals gives me a cross cap. This was actually known in context of string theory and also conformal field theories that if you collide rho with rho partial transpose, you may get non-orientable manifolds. And also it was used by Polman and Turner in the context of spin chains. So they showed that this object distinguishes Haldane phase from the trivial phase of a spin one chain. They didn't really advertise it as a partition function on RP2, but the underlying reason that their topological invariant actually works, or this quantity works for them, is because they're putting spin chains on RP2.
Is there any connection of this with calculation of topological entanglement in quantum dimension by, there is a prescription by Kitaev and Persky.
Right.
Is there any connection of that?
So that's mostly for topological order in two spatial dimensions. Right now I'm talking about one spatial direction. Yeah, actually one can apply this to two dimensional case, and there you'll see something similar. Yeah. Yes.
You might have covered this before because I came late. These are operations on the density matrix.
Yes.
And you're drawing space-time diagrams.
Yeah. Yes.
What's the connection between?
Oh, so. Right. So you can look. You can define a ground state wave function, just by taking some arbitrary initial state and apply E2 minus beta H, or the discrete version of that, infinitely many times. So if you start with some state, arbitrary state psi, and you apply it so many times, you're guaranteed to get the ground state, okay, on this edge. Okay, now let me use this to explain what do I mean by density matrix in that picture. So now, suppose that this is, again, from minus infinity, okay, to plus infinity, and I make a cut at zero. This gives me a ground state, and this gives me another ground state, right? So I'm doing from minus infinity to zero, gives me a ket, and if I do it from plus infinity to zero, it gives me bra, okay? Now, I want to represent density matrix in this picture in terms of like path integral. So if I trace out these parts, I get this region, only untraced. So this now represents the density matrix.
Density matrix for a subsystem.
Yes, yes, for this subsystem.
Yes.
Of length L. Yeah, this is what I mean here. So I have two subsystems which corresponds to these two subsystems. And multiplication is simply sewing them together. So you identify some of these, you identify these with these. So that's the multiplication. And then taking trace is identifying these two with these two, which is shown here as these arrows. So these two arrows, this one is identified with this, this one is identified with that. Now remember, this guy is just this.
You have two copies of spade? I'm still...
Yes. Because it is trace row squared, right? It's row times row.
You're saying if you want to compute this, you would do the path integral on that?
Yes.
This space
time. Yes. This picture actually very helpful. And sometimes, like in case of CFTs, you can do the calculations analytically. I'm going to show you some results for a slightly different quantity. But yeah, this picture is quite useful. Once you know the topology of the manifold, for example, in case of topological phases, then that's all you need. So if it is RP2, then it should give you this eighth root of unity in case of topological superconductor.
If you have an explicit matrix product state, suppose you are given explicit matrix product wave,
yes,
then this interpretation is not necessary because you will, there is no time in the way that you motivate it.
Yes, exactly. So all you need, so here, like very similar to the Chern number, you're given a state. Okay, you twist the boundary condition, then you look at the Berry phase. So here you're given a density matrix, or you're given a ground state. You can always construct the reduced density matrix, right? And you compute this quantity. So this gives you the information whether that matrix product, say, or that ground state represents a topological superconductor or not. That's what we mean by topological invariant, actually.
You can also give this interpretation in terms of...
Yes. And the reason that I'm saying this is because I already know that RP2 distinguishes different topological superconductors. Then it can be used as a proof that this quantity distinguishes topological superconductors.
Is there a way to see that's a topological invariant without going through this S-integral way of thinking?
In some cases, yes. So in case of topological superconductors, which I'm showing right now, the answer is yes. You can show that it's a topological invariant. You can basically deform the ground state by set of local unitaries which preserve the symmetry and show that the phase does not change. That means it's a topological quantity. It doesn't change under smooth deformations unless you close gap or something like that. Yeah, we have studied several cases. So in some cases, I'm still working on showing that whether it's a this quantization. So I know that it's quantized, but yeah, I don't have like a down-to-earth derivation or concrete proof of that, besides showing that it's the desirable manifold. Yes?
All right, so what's the U1 doing for you? Because it must be doing something.
Oh, so here right now I'm just studying topological superconductors. I don't have a U1 symmetry here.
Well, you've got Z equals trace of rho U1 rho partial transpose U.
Oh, sorry. So these are just the unitary part of the time reversal. Yeah. Oh, let me give you an example. For example, in case of fermions, if you have spin up and spin down, so what time reversal does is it sends spin up to spin down and sends spin down to minus spin up, okay? So then if I use just some generic notation, then I can just use just some unitary part. Something like this. So this is the unitary part. So here it's just fully off diagonal.
Right, because what's bothering me is it's an algebraic fact that trace of rho times rho partial transpose is just trace rho squared.
Oh, say it again.
Well, you can write it that with matrices. Rho times rho partial transpose equals trace rho squared. This is a well-known fact.
This?
Yep.
We can probably discuss it later, but I don't think so.
Do it with matrices. It's that simple.
Oh, so you're thinking, sorry for the confusion. So you're thinking about this as a matrix transposition. It's not just a matrix transposition. Okay, sorry.
Partial transpose.
Yes, so I'm dealing with
partial transpose.
Fermions. Yeah, so I should probably emphasize this. So I'm dealing with fermions, and what I call transpose is not just a matrix transposition. There is a phase factor.
I'll have to check afterwards whether that breaks it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, this is actually important. If you don't include the phase factor, you recover the bosonic classification. So you get just a Z2 invariant. Yeah. Yes, thanks. Yeah, so here I'm using partial transpose for these two different things.
Right.
But what I mean is most here is exclusively partial transpose of fermions, which is accompanied by this phase.
Partial transpose with a phase factor.
Yes.
Right.
Okay, so this is a topological invariant, and one simple example is if you just take a generic topological superconductor and use this bulk boundary correspondence to represent the ground, the reduced density matrix in terms of the low energy entanglement spectrum, then you can compute this, and that's the picture. So you have the long chain, and you look at the low energy part of the reduced density matrix of this region. And it is it can be represented by a Majorana dimer here, and then here, and then there. And one can do the calculation. It's a few lines of calculations using the definition of the fermionic partial transpose, and you'll see that here this eighth root of unity appears in the topological phase, and then in the trivial phase where these bonds are absent, you get basically one. So this picture can be used to get also other non-orientable manifolds. So here I'm showing another example. It's a Klein bottle. So if you apply partial transpose to two disjoint intervals, then you effectively get a Klein bottle. And one can also twist the boundary condition, like this cycle of a Klein bottle, to explore possible spin structures of fermions on Klein bottle. Let me show you another example. This shows the quantization of the phase probably most clearly. So now I'm computing this quantity for two cases, for when these two intervals are next to each other, so what I call the RP2 here, and then the other case where they are separate from each other. And I'm computing this for the Majorana chain. It's a non-interacting system, but here the input is just the interacting wave function, okay? And you see that the nice quantization. So in the trivial phase, there is no, so this is the complex phase, this is the amplitude. In the trivial phase, there is no complex phase, so it's just zero. And then in the topological phase, you see these plateaus at the eighth root of unity and the fourth root of unity. So for Klein bottle and the RP2. And then this is how the amplitude behaves. And the amplitude actually is related to second Rennie entropy. Yes.
How large are the intervals to get this plot?
So
do you need to increase the size of the interval as you get close to a transition?
Yes, it needs to be large enough, yes.
So always larger than the correlational limit?
Yes. You need to be always in the topological limit for this to work. Effectively, this guy should act as a topological defect, this cross cap. And the requirement is that the size of cross cap should be larger than the correlation length, bulk correlation
length. So that plot, there was something, I mean, a lot of effort that went into near the boundary between
yes.
the field.
Yes.
You have to consider a very large system.
Yes, okay. That's right.
What's the horizontal axis? Is this
flat? Yes, so I'm studying the Majorana chain. So Majorana chain as a function of chemical potential gives you trivial phase here, this purple region, and the orange region is the topological phase. It's a chemical potential in the Kitaev chain. Any other question? Okay, so let me just briefly show you this. So we mentioned that, I mentioned that the classification is Z8, so then there has to be a way to show the Z8 cyclic property of the Z8 group, and here simply is if you stack n copies of the Kitaev chain, because it's a complex phase, then you just add up the phases. And if you stack 8 copies, you get just a 2π phase, which is the same as trivial phase. So this is how the cyclic property appears. And also, this method of creating crosscaps can be used to create arbitrary non-orientable manifold. So one can put multiple crosscaps, and the result is shown here. So these are just different different plots show that this quantity Z for n crosscaps. So for one crosscap, as I showed you, it gives you just 2π divided by 8. If you put two crosscaps, you get 4π divided by 8. I mean, in some sense here, I'm showing that the topological phase can be used to classify different manifolds. Yes?
You look at the Majorana model, the edge, the topology. Can you guess the Z8? Is there a way of seeing just by looking at one Majorana model? Because the Kitaev chain, when you solve it.
Yeah, the Z8, the observation of Z8 is not actually very trivial. So you need to, I think in the original paper, Lukasz Fitkowski and Kitaev considered a rather complicated looking interaction to show that 8 copies can be adiabatically connected. So they exactly studied the edge modes, the Majorana zero modes at the boundary. But the type of interaction that they wrote is rather complicated looking to show that 8 copies can be adiabatically connected to a trivial phase.
But it's there, the symmetry is there. You
yes.
showed interaction.
Yes. Okay, so I think I'm running out of time. So let me tell you a little bit why this RP2 is relevant. So I was hoping to show you some results about entanglement, but probably it's not doable in such short time. Okay, so the main observation from mathematical physics is that SPT phases at the low energy can be described by spin TQFT. So spin TQFT is just a TQFT on spin manifold where in addition to local frame field, you start with a Riemann manifold, but then you define the transition functions in the spin group or pin group, depending on the symmetry. And the important point in the context of TQFT is that the partition function is a mapping from a manifold with the background gauge field to a U1 phase. And TQFT can distinguish different manifolds up to this cobordism group. So if you have two different manifolds here and you compute the partition function of TQFTs on two different manifolds, which can be thought as a boundary of a higher dimensional manifold, then you do not see any difference in this U1 phase. Okay, that's what I mean by TQFT is a mapping from a cobordism group to a U1 phase. And the generators of this cobordism group then can be used to distinguish different topological phases. So in the case of topological superconductors, the spin TQFT called a pin minus and the generating manifold, meaning the manifold that gives the most fundamental phase is RP2 actually. So that's just some relation to mathematics. So actually one can go to other cases, and this picture is rather general. So one can look at different symmetry groups. So here I'm showing you the 1D case and study different the corresponding topological invariant for each symmetry class. I mean, so this is rather busy slide. So let me just tell you very quickly what these things are. Note that here I always have rho partial transpose, and so on. So pretty much it's the same thing. And these operators, extra operators, is just some unitaries depending on the symmetry. So then the important message is one can use this framework to define topological invariants for all anti-unitary symmetries. And one can try higher dimensions, but let me not get into that. And let me finish. Let me finish just by saying a few things about the applications. So I think there are several numerical applications to this approach. One can implement this time reversal in path integral and quantum Monte Carlo calculations, also tensor network models. So actually our method was already used by Verstrate's group, where they found this quantization in some fermionic and matrix product states. So one natural generalization is, can we define some partial transpose for anions and study the symmetry-enriched topological order where you have now fractionalization? There was a question earlier about topological order. So one question is whether we can define topological invariants for non-chiral topological order, which are protected by some symmetries. And then I didn't have a chance to tell you, but one can look at just the spectrum of partial transpose. And that turns out to give an intrinsic measure of entanglement for fermions. And exactly that U1 phase that I mentioned in the partial transpose of fermion can give you some extra information which can distinguish Majorana dimers. Whereas just partial transpose, the matrix partial transpose can only distinguish can only detect Bell pairs. And then there are some relevant questions then in the context of entanglement distillation for fermions. Yeah, with that, I would like to thank you. And if you have any questions. Yes?
In the last part that you said, this partial transpose can give you information about the intrinsic entanglement of fermions. It's entanglement besides the uncertainty, the statistics of the fermion. So if I think it in a single particle base, a Slater determinant is entangled, right?
Right. So what I'm saying is, for example, let me give you this example. If you just take two Majorana sites, okay, and entangle them through this Hamiltonian. Okay? So this is the density matrix that you get. And if you just apply partial transpose, like just matrix partial transpose, it doesn't change the density matrix. So meaning partial transpose really doesn't give you the fact that this state is not separable. But if you use this fermionic partial transpose, then you will see that you get half of log 2. Which shows a Majorana dimer, which is kind of half of a Bell pair, say. In that sense, it's an intrinsic measure because it can detect Majorana dimers, which is absent in a bosonic theory.
I think maybe you're talking about two different entanglements. Maybe you're talking about entanglement between one particle and another particle. Whereas this is like one site and another site.
Yes, this is mode entanglement.
Mode.
Yes, this is mode entanglement. Yeah. But I think at the end of the day, mode entanglement is what is useful for identical part.
Yes.
Yeah.
But sometimes people say that the anti-symmetry of the wave function is already a kind of entanglement. I think that's
right.
I may be wrong.
Right. No. I think that's what you meant.
Right.
So it's not useful entanglement in a sense.
Well, no, but the thing is that for this Majorana dimer, right, you can actually use it to teleport a Majorana with similar protocol as ordinary teleportation. So it is actually useful entanglement. That's
all I see.
Yeah, I think it's about teleporting modes or teleporting physical particles. I don't think teleporting physical particles is very useful. Yes, so what I'm saying here is mode entanglement, which is useful for measurement-based quantum information. Let's say.
Right.
Yeah.
A related question. The KTAO chain has this spin representation. Quantum.
Yes.
I see more of the transfer.
Yes.
Some of these things become more transparent, the language of spins.
Right. Oh, so one thing is there is this Jordan-Wigner string, right?
So and do that and then just talk in terms of spins alone.
Right. So, because the Jordan-Wigner operator actually does not transform trivially under this partial transpose. That's where the difference comes in, yeah.
You're hitting the strings.
Yeah.
So does your method apply to interacting from any capacity?
Yes, that was the main motivation. So we tried it. Yes, we didn't. I didn't show any example of interacting. Yes, but one
that
can.
That means not the SPT has a free framing description. It's those intrinsic interacting SPTs that people are talking about.
Right. You mean like what is usually known as interaction enabled SPTs?
Yeah.
Yes, in 3D, for example, I have one, there is this example of Z2 cube classification, Wong, Potter, and Sento. Yes, that it can be used to not just distinguish the first Z2, which is adiabatically connected to the non-interacting. The other two can be also studied using this method. Yes. Yes.
I'm still trying to understand in my own mind why you get a topological phasor. And is it? I mean, you explained how you relate that formula in terms of the density matrices mm-hmm. to this path integral.
Yes.
And the space-time topology.
Matters, yes. It can distinguish topological from trivial,
but
yes.
It's also an important feature that the field theory you're doing is some sort of topological field theory. Otherwise...
So the fact that the phases...
Just knowing the topology of the manifold wouldn't give you a unique answer. You see what I mean?
So there are two... two different independent subjects, right. So one is just classification of two-dimensional closed manifold.
Right.
And then there is the partition function of fermions on manifolds.
Right.
So these two actually related by this identification, which was observed actually rather recently, that TQFDs can be used to distinguish, to classify manifolds.
Okay.
So now I'm saying the opposite way. Also, manifolds can be used to distinguish TQFDs. They are, equivalent.
So
but
it's just my own ignorance, but why is it a TQFT?
Why is it a TQFT?
Yes.
I think this is still a conjecture. There's no proof of that because, you know, when you take a lattice model, so TQFDs here, particularly spin TQFDs, is a theory where you start with spin manifold. So spin manifold is a manifold where you put relativistic fermions on. So the question is whether SPTs are described by relativistic fermions or not. And a priori, you don't know that at a lattice level, you don't have Lorentz invariants, right?
No.
And it's not really clear that why this is relativistic, why it can be described by a relativistic theory. But then you can think of relativistic fermion as an emergent low energy theory.
Right. So it's just a conjecture. But there's some. Is that right? First of all, this is Euclidean signature, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
We are trying to do Euclidean signature path integral in canonical formalism. Yes.
But then even if it's a spinner, a relativistic spinner, it doesn't necessarily make it a TQ topological field theory, does it? I mean, I could write down other field theories that wouldn't be topological.
Oh, we are interested in the topological part of the action. So the rest is just energetics.
Yeah, so that, how does that go?
Well, that comes in...
Low energy will be topological. That's the statement?
Yes, always topological response. The topological response shows up as a low energy response. Yes. So we are studying a gapped phase, and we are looking. We are interested in the low energy description of a gapped phase, which is purely topological.
How do we know it's purely? I mean, maybe.
Oh, because as you so what do I mean by topological is that as you deform the system, once you keep the gap. Open the bulk gap, open or you don't close it, then you don't make a topological change to the state.
Yeah.
That's where the meaning of this topological response comes.
But in the field theory language, it means there's no local degrees of freedom. Is that just because you're at such low energy that?
Yes, that's why you have to be in the topological limit. Yes, there is a coarse grained picture. And this, the many body invariant that I'm showing, there was also the question that how big this cross cap should be. So the requirement that the cross cap should be much larger than the correlation length is exactly why we have to be in the topological limit. Yeah.
And I have one more question. Three dimensions. Can you do an arbitrary three manifold? I mean, there's an infinite number.
Okay, very good. So all we need to know is the generators of the cobordism group, and let's say
for 3D, I think the cobordism group is 3D.
Yes, but you need to depends on the spin TQFD. Okay. So, for example, I can give you an example that the generating manifold is RP3. RP3 is orientable, okay?
Yes.
But still can distinguish like non-chiral phases of P plus IP superconductor. So then I can give the topological invariant just in terms of expectation value, which simulates RP3.
So that's
very similar to what I did here for RP2.
So it has to be a spin cobordism, basically.
Yes, it's a...
It's, cobordism has to be with a spinner.
Yes.
Spin structure.
Right, yes.
So Hassan is here today and tomorrow. Any of you guys like to be with him? Otherwise, let's thank him again.
Thank you.